This episode, I'm joined by James Machin and Tim Jarvis to discuss the work of Arthur Machen. I'd like to say a big thank you to my paying patrons and subscribers for their ongoing support. And if you've enjoyed anything which Hermetics has published throughout the year, then please think about subscribing, as patronage alone keeps the podcast running. Otherwise, have a very happy new year and enjoy. So, James Machin and Tim Jarvis, thanks to you both for joining us on Hermetics podcast. So we are going to be discussing the work of Arthur Machen, who people will know probably primarily for the collections The Great God Pan and Other Stories, or The White People and Other Stories. These are the two most well-known popular mainstream collections. And as a figure, people will know him from within the weird fiction genre, the horror genre, possibly the occult genre, and also maybe if you dug deep, you could possibly say the sort of folk or Celtic Christianity genre, if you're really, really interested in that. And also, I think people might usual path, at least it was my own, was sort of you go, oh, I really like the work of Lovecraft, but I'm bored about reading a man who keeps saying it's indescribable, so I want to read someone else who is like this, and you'd have all these figures alongside Poe, Machen being one of them, and others. But we are focusing on Arthur Machen, who I'll say before we begin, I personally much prefer to Lovecraft, as they're often posted together. But I'm joined by Tim and James. So you, along with Sam Kunkel, who may join us later, you three are now the editors of Faunus, which is the journal for the Friends of Arthur Machen Society, and I hope I've got that right. So just whichever order you want to go in, we'll keep this open and free flowing. Just tell us a little bit about yourselves, and I guess for each of you, what it is you do.
Okay, I'm James Machin, and I've been editing Faunus, the journal of Friends of Arthur Machen, since 2013, I think. And then was subsequently joined by Tim and latterly Sam. So Tim's been co-editor with me for the past few years. And other than that, I'm currently freelance editor and proofreader, but have had various sort of academic jobs, teaching jobs over the last couple of decades. And that's how I've been keeping myself busy. But I've had a lifelong interest in Arthur Machen, and James, as you, is exactly the same route for me. It was Lovecraft, basically, was the gateway, and I read Lovecraft's essay Supernatural Horror and Literature, and was kind of blown away by Lovecraft's descriptions of Machen's writing, which I actually really value that as a piece of sort of writing by Lovecraft in itself. His descriptions of Machen's books are in some ways, perhaps not equal to Machen's books themselves, but I'm very fond of them anyway. So yeah, absolutely, through Lovecraft is how I came to Machen.
My name's Tim Jarvis, and I'm a senior lecturer in creative writing at Anglia Ruskin University at the moment. As James was saying, I joined the editorial team at Faunus. I don't know when that was, but like a little while after you'd been doing it for a little while on your own, I think. But which is, been really, really enjoyable, really rewarding. But I had a different route to Machen, I think. When I was at university in the late 90s, one of my favorite writers, still one of my favorite writers, writer M. John Harrison, and he had a short story called The Great God Pan, and talked in interviews about the influence of Machen's writing on his work. So I think my route to Machen was picking up the Dover Press, James, you'll know, Dover Press edition, which has which was one of
the Hill of Dreams and The Great God Pan.
And read The Great God Pan and really liked it, and then read The Hill of Dreams and found it even more, because I think the move away from horror into that sort of strange sublimity that you get in Hill of Dreams was my, the sort of the gateway to Machen. And then I don't think I actually read Lovecraft till later. I think I didn't read Lovecraft till I was doing my PhD in my mid to late 20s, and everybody said, oh, you're interested in weird fiction. Have you not read Lovecraft? Maybe read
it is amazing that you managed to avoid him.
Yeah, my route was very different. I think, M. John Harrison, but I had definitely read sort of Blackwood and M. R. James as a sort of young teenager, but hadn't read Mackin. And then so came to Mackin through M. John Harrison's short story, The Great God Pan, really.
That is a very unique route. Well, I'll open just with a broad question just to get things flowing, which almost just seems like a silly question. But who is this man who, as we were talking about before we started, is from, I believe, born 1867? Have I got that right in my memory?
1863, I think.
1863 through to, was it 1947? Maybe that's where I got the seven from. But yeah, his life is bordering this, as you were saying, James, before we started, bordering this strange area where you, if you're a literary figure, you will have context across the board. And sort of infamously, he said he ended up living off tea and tobacco, I believe. He wasn't well off for the majority of his life. Whether or not that's true, I guess we'll see. But if I was to ask you the question, who was this man? How would you answer that?
Well, if I may, Tim, that just going from that last comment, he was a great self-mythologizer, and there's been this conflation between his work and his life. So people do have misapprehensions against him. And the idea that he lived a life of grinding poverty is one of those misapprehensions, because he really didn't. And if you're being a bit harsh, you could say he spent a couple of years in London really struggling, sort of the age of the sort of student age, I guess, and never shut up complaining about it for the rest of his life. But that's a bit glib, because he did face periods of financial hardship, absolutely. And he was the beneficiary of, grants by the Royal Society of Authors and so on to support him and his young family. So he did have difficult times, absolutely. But also, he was a great success at first. And he also came into some serious inheritances, bought a huge house in the countryside in the 1890s. He self-mythologized and has been mythologized, I think. So, he lived a long life with ups and downs, and it's difficult to, to pin him down to one kind of stereotype, I suppose. But also that's helped by the whole mythology of the 1890s and, the decadent artists sort of struggling and starving and living on opium and little else. So there is that definite sort of mythology of decadence as well. Yeats is sort of, what does he call them, tragic generation. So he's been kind of absorbed into that myth a bit as well.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I think what makes him quite slippery as a writer as to place is that there are these very distinct, three very distinct kind of periods in his writing and his style. And he's, like I was saying, he sort of straddles quite a long swathe of literary history and is associated with a lot of writers who don't have that longevity, because he's writing all the way from the 1880s, even slightly before, right into the 1940s, 1930, end of the 1930s. So it's a lot, it's a long period to be writing. And most people, I don't think, read the first period of his work, which I think is the most difficult and the least interesting in some ways, because he's what does he say, James, in the intro to The House of Souls, he talks about this, doesn't he? He says something like that he's writing in the ornate style of the early 17th century or something.
It was kind of pastiche. Very difficult stuff. Sorry to interrupt.
So it's sort of, and I'm trying to think. So there's works like The Anatomy of Tobacco and translations of 17th century French texts, all in this sort of slightly earlier period of odd writing before.
And they're all extremely kind of impenetrable in jokes, basically, that you have to be, incredibly dank, I think, especially for the modern reader. Difficult to get much out of, I think, unless you're much more erudite than I am.
Yeah, because he does a Rabelaisian parody of a Welsh folk tale collection called The Chronicles of Clemendy, which is a kind of sort of Boccaccio meets, you know, some sort of Welsh folklore. And it, you know, it's very difficult to read, and it's written in that very ornate style. But then he moves into that decadent mode at the end of the 1880s and starts writing some short stories that do feel quite contemporary, but they're definitely part of that moment of the 1890s, the fin de siècle moment, and they have that style.
Machen would probably describe that period as his Stevensonian period, because he acknowledged very freely his massive debt to Stevenson. And it's, if you read, you know, Grey God Pan and The Three Impostors, it's impossible to escape the influence of Stevenson. He kind of, you know, used Stevenson's portmanteau works like The Dynamiters and The New Arabian Nights. He kind of took that formula, and also the sort of Stevenson sort of the jaunty manner of Stevenson, of the, you know, Dyson and Phillips being sort of jaunty men about town. That's quite Stevensonian as well.
He's experimenting a bit, isn't it? Because there's some of those not that early, but the beginning of that sort of second phase stories, they're almost like, there are some stories that are almost in the mode of sort of Maupassant or something, a kind of realist, realist. I can't remember. Is it called The Wrong Woman or something? There's that one that's got no supernatural element at all, but it's just about he meets his friend.
Double Return or something. Yeah.
Although that has doppelgangers, it does have a slightly supernatural feel, doesn't it? But yeah. And then there's this shift into the mid-90s and towards the end of the 90s, where he's writing in a very recognisably fin de siècle decadent sort of style. I think that's where a lot of people would say his greatest work lies. Hill of Dreams, which is completed in 1897, but not published till 1910. That's partly to do with the Wild trial, isn't it, James? The delay of the publication of the work from that.
Machen called the Wild trial the great disaster. I think that was his phrase for it, because basically everybody scattered who was associated with that style of writing and decadence. And it became, you know, very dangerous, based personally damaging to be associated with decadence. And publishers wouldn't, you know, no longer wanted to touch it with the barge pole, basically. So Machen felt that completely sort of hamstrung him, because he was so associated with the decadent movement, rightly or wrongly. But obviously having, you know, two books in John Lane's keynote series, which were the decadent imprint, with Aubrey Beardsley frontispieces and so on. Mm. So it was tricky for him to escape. But he didn't, despite that, as Tim's just said, he didn't abandon that style at all. He sort of leaned further into it, which, you know, seems quite a sort of, I don't know what the word for it, self-sabotaging move. But, you know, he was an artist. He followed his artistic instincts. And, to basically call the Wild trial a disaster and then write The Hill of Dreams seems a very sort of odd career move, basically.
He does, you're right. There's lots of work in that period that he pursues this style. So, yeah, Hill of Dreams is actually 1907 published. But then some of the other work that he starts in that period doesn't get published till much later, does it? There's the stories in Ornaments in Jade, doesn't get published until the mid-1920s, I think. The Secret Glory, which I think he writes over quite a long period, but started again in the very end of the 1890s, and it doesn't get published again till the 1920s, I think. So he kept those stories and kept, presumably, you know, trying to find a moment where things would come back in his favor, which actually happened with the interest in the US in his 1890s work. I think that was partly the catalyst for the for the final publication of some of these lost pieces from the end of the...
Yeah, I'm not sure on the timings of that, because my understanding is that was the sort of American interest was more 1920s that started getting going in earnest. But it certainly led to, lots more stuff being published, basically, for the American market. And in America, or published, or what's the word I'm searching for? Illegally printed. What's the word I'm looking for? Bootlegged. According to Mackin, who had a big falling out with Vincent Starrett, I think, yeah, who printed some couple of books by Mackin, and Mackin claimed that he sort of willfully misunderstood a letter. That didn't, in fact, give him permission to do this. But actually, Starrett basically said, well, look, this is the letter he wrote to me, and it sort of unambiguously did give him permission. So, yeah.
Yeah, the letter is pretty clear, isn't it? I think yeah. It, yeah. He obviously just forgot that's what he said.
To draw in all these threads before we jump into what Mackin's work is like. I mean, so we have a self-mythologizer who is writing Rabelaisian 17th century in-jokes that almost no one in the time would probably get, who's getting annoyed at a letter that was unambiguous. So I guess just to tie in with the sort of literal biography, I mean, what was he like? How much do we know about what he was actually like as a person? Because thus far, he's coming across as a bit precocious.
he was definitely a high church sort of Tory, wasn't he, James? So he was... He was definitely, it's interesting, the Lovecraft connection, because they're both sort of conservative or even, you might say, reactionary, although in completely opposite directions of reaction, if that makes sense. His religious faith was very important to him. And it was, he described it as Anglo-Catholic towards the later period, didn't he, James? And
it's high Anglican, yeah.
A quite a mystical version, almost Neoplatonic version of Anglican Christianity.
So it's so, yeah, it's
you know, that
Catholic
that
with whole... a small C, Catholic with a small C, because he was very into the idea of apostolic succession from the the early church fathers, and his idea of Christianity was pre-Reformation Christianity. So that was another part of his anti-modernism or anti-modernity, basically, because he thought that the Reformation was the worst thing that ever happened anywhere in history. So he was one of those sort of late Victorians like Thomas Carlyle, who were always raging against the Reformation.
So he was a pre-Reformation Protestant.
Yes, but so high, so a Catholic, small C Catholic, basically, not a Roman Catholic. But a high church Catholic, so it's it's very difficult to sort of fathom for those not in the thickets of theology with him,
and also connected to that, and again in stark contrast to Lovecraft, he thought that the 18th century and the Enlightenment and the Age of Reason were the worst things that happened to. In human history, that they had destroyed the possibility of mystery and ecstasy in the world. So completely diametrically opposed to Lovecraft, for whom that was the the greatest 100 years in human civilization, I guess, who held up the the Age of Reason as being this sort of pinnacle of order. For Mackin, it was a tragedy, right? I think the Enlightenment was a disaster.
Yeah, it was the introduction of the age of rationalism and commerce and the sort of degraded, modern industrial lifestyle, which he hated. But, back to your original question about what he was like as a person, you can actually hear him speak, because there's a BBC recording of him from the radio, and you can hear, a very sort of sonorous, I guess you'd say, voice with a sort of Welsh lilt. And he was very social and very popular. So, despite having these sorts of strong opinions about various things, he was clearly very well liked. And he was a noted raconteur and pub person. And when he was a journalist, in the early 20th century, he was a sort of Fleet Street character. He walked around with a sort of Inverness cape and a hat and a shock of white hair, and was basically boozing a lot of the time and amusing people with endless anecdotes. He was a lot of fun to be around by all accounts. And he used to host legendary parties in Amersham and in London when he was in London that involved making a sort of insanely strong punch and basically getting everybody absolutely blasted off their face. They were very popular parties by all accounts.
There's a great essay about the parties in St. John's Wood, isn't there? Dog and Duck. Punch, Dog and Duck. And then there was a game that he got his guests to play once they were extremely inebriated in the sort of courtyard or back garden space of this flat that he lived in, which involved, if I remember rightly, rolling a bald tennis ball around a curved path or something like that. And, you know, it was sort of basically impossible, especially if you were hammered on chartreuse and this, you know, whatever this concoction was. So he was definitely, you know, he was fun, and that, you know, there's a playfulness in the text as well. I mean, that's why writers like Borges admire Machen so much. There's a metatextual, a very kind of you know, he's not a self-serious writer in a way. There's a sort of playful metatextuality, I think, especially to coming back the third phase of his writing, where he leaves decadence and become and the work gets sort of starker and more influenced by his journalism. He'll often play with these conceits where he'll bring up real stories from his journalistic days and then use them to frame a fictional story. So you know, a bit like with Borges, you can't really tell where the fiction and the truth are begin and end, and there's a sort of blurring.
And that's kind of the point to them, isn't it? To establish that sort of mystery.
Yeah, and again, sort of, I mean, because Love, you know, we're coming back to Lovecraft just because we sort of mentioned it, but Lovecraft does a similar thing with metatext and found manuscripts and framing of text, but not with the lightness and the playfulness that I think that Machen brings to that trope. Yeah.
So absolutely, especially in his later work like The Green Round.
I was just going to say, there seems to be a point then where there is a leap from this early Machen, who is perhaps more, you know, writing these tongue-in-cheek literary, more, you know, the Anatomy of Tobacco, for instance, being one of the earliest examples. But it seems to be a leap into or a step into the Machen that, if you know him, you know him for, such as the, you know, and I'll put horror in quotation marks, because whether or not it's a like Lovecraft horror is really, I guess, probably something we'll touch upon. But there seems to be this point where he steps towards this. And, you know, I just want to draw in this thing you mentioned about commerce and about reason and about his relationship to them. Do you think perhaps there's a possibility that he began or stepped into this arena of horror because of seeing the mystery is starting to leave the world because of reason? And so, you know, that writing allows him to re-enchant the world. But equally, it's a world where reason is sort of winning, commerce is winning, and that's where the horror comes from.
Oh, yeah. One of his most sort of, you know, repeated quotes about his own work, certainly by me, actually, is that when he's talking about his writing, his horror writing, in inverted quotes, he writes that his mistake was translating awe or awfulness into evil. He says that was a mistake. So the actual, you know, aesthetic affect he was trying to create was one of awe, but it came, you know, arrived on the page as horror, basically. So he regretted that, which seems baffling because, you know, that's actually what he's most sort of celebrated for these days, at least. He was definitely trying to create a specific affect in his writing to do with creating the sense of the numinous and of awe and of mystery, which was kind of, I guess you could go back to Anne Radcliffe and her distinction between terror and horror, and terror being something that sort of is uplifting and enriches the soul and the spirit, with horror sort of degrading it or debasing it. So I think he sort of was aiming for sort of a sort of superior sense of terror, and you know, arrived at what he considered to be sort of tawdry horror, which, you know, I don't agree at all with that summation of what he did, but he certainly considered that to be his misstep.
Yeah, because he writes in the same bit of the one of the biographies, he writes a couple of times, in fact, that you dream as a writer, you dream in fire, but you work in clay. You know, this sense that yeah. the literary work isn't a good medium for getting across the sublimity or the ecstasy, which is his goal, and that's what he talks about in the volume Hieroglyphics, which is his playful treatise on what he values most in literary endeavor. But I was going back to the reason, because he does use a trope in work. He moves away in his work, but in The Great God Pan, he sort of relies on the trope from Stevenson of the sort of the mad scientist. So even though it's not much of the book, the first chapter of the book where the experiment is made is a kind of, you know, the vision of Pan, of evil, is brought about by brain surgery, by you know, using a scalpel. So there's a materiality to the genesis of the horror, which I think goes, in some ways, disappears from his later work. There's an interesting sort of shift where, I think, in Mackin's work, from the decadent work, which does rely on some of the tropes of a sort of material cause for horror, to a later, basically kind of numinous work that's written in a much plainer style. It's kind of, it's an interesting shift. But yes, I wonder if part of the, you know, using the trope, picking up on the evil science trope, is Mackin railing against reason and science, which he in his journals from the 1890s, he's constantly talking about the evils of science and how, you know, the mystery of the world is being, you know, the world is being stripped or denuded by this this pernicious kind of, you know, force in human nature, or human knowledge. I don't know. Yeah. So there's definitely the reaction against science and horror somehow kind of conflated in The Great God Pan, with the noumenal Neoplatonic stuff in a weird way.
So, segueing from where we are, I mean, I guess this is the, in a way, it's a strange subject that we've been tiptoeing around the whole discussion, which is that if it's sort of one of these popular possible misconception, if Mackin is known, and I mean, you know, he's fairly well known, he gets, you know, within that arena, but he's known within the arena of horror. But every time we've mentioned horror, we've said horror in quotation marks, or the numinous, or, you know, perhaps even the ethereal. So, you know, what is Mackinian horror, if it is a thing, if it is horror at all?
In the Penguin edition the Oxford's World Classics edition, edited by Aaron Worth, the yellow book, is that Penguin or Oxford?
Oxford.
I can't remember.
Oxford.
Oh, it's Oxford, isn't it? Yeah. He identifies some really interesting things there, and one of them he identifies as Mackinian is this idea of deep history and deep time, sort of, you know, recurring back into the past, basically, erupting into the present, basically. So that's a trope which is there from the very earliest writings right to the end. And normally in the figure of, you know, that Mackin's little people, he's famous for his little people, which is a really interesting subject in its own right, you know, how that idea first occurred to him, which seems to be based on this euhemerist called MacRitchius, a Scottish sort of anthropologist and folklorist, who had this idea that there were pre-Celtic indigenous peoples and sort of signs of that culture can be discovered in the landscape and in sort of you know barrows and so on. I don't think it would be called sort of pseudoscience now, but Macken was clearly very inspired by that. So yeah, I'd say Macken's horror is very much a horror of the eruption of this sort of baffling, evil, pre-Christian, unknown past into the present, I think. And he had that in his he kind of experienced that in his personal life as well. And this might not quite track onto that, but you know, he had this striking comment about walking through London, which he did a lot, and then finding that an area which previously been, you know, all green, was now rows and rows of new build villas. And he thought it was absolutely horrific. And he felt, I think I'm right, I hope I'm not conflating two things, but I think he felt the sensation was like suddenly like stumbling over an anaconda or something. It was a sort of visceral disgust. That's another aspect of his writing, which I think is sort of distinctly Macanian. But that kind of shock of some sudden intrusion of something, you know, utterly alien into the reality, the sort of punctual reality by something utterly, you know, I don't know. I've run out of my thread with that thought, but hopefully Tim can step in and rescue me.
Yeah, I was thinking it's that the new build stuff is right there in the 1890s. I think that's really interesting because it's the idea of the suburb is quite a kind of feature of some of the 1890s stories, and that idea of getting lost in
always desolate wastes, aren't they, the suburbs?
Yeah, because In the Inmost Light is sort of set in Willesden or something, isn't it? I think that's right, isn't it? So you know, this sort of the horror of this transposition of the soul into a crystal takes place in this, you know, at the edge, you know, what would have then been the very edge of London in a kind of new estate, bordering the fields, and the sort of reality and the horror are conflated in some way. But yeah, I think it's, I mean, the thing about of, you know, sort of failing to produce awe and translating, you know, the translating awfulness into evil that he talks about in Far Off Things is, I think that's at the key of, you know, that's key to his thinking around horror, because I think what he's really trying to get at is this ecstatic mode that he writes about in Hieroglyphics, where through, because Hieroglyphics is sort of framed as a discourse with an obscure literary hermit that Macken meets in Barnsbury, or kind of is invited into this man's basement flat in Barnsbury, and he has this conversation in this man's rooms, and it returns again, and they talk about literature. And you, although Macken is sort of, you're putting these words into the mouth of this character, we can understand that this is something of Macken's own poetics, or his own sort of theory of his own literary approach. And it is this aiming for ecstasy as being the, which he never really fully explains. You know, he sort of refers to ecstasy, or tries to define ecstasy really tautologously. He's you know, by using words like beauty,
very circular definition, isn't it? Yeah.
But I guess the thing about the horror is that when you do genuinely access this kind of ecstatic mode, there's dissolution, and that's the horror. I think that's, you know, in his late work, especially the late short story N, you see, I think, some of the real kind of sort of impetus behind that mode. The thing in N that the people encounter isn't in and of itself horrifying, but because it's too much, it's too extreme, it's too close to something divine, ordinary mortals can't handle being in its presence and suffer delusions and madness. And one of the characters, a peripheral character in the story, is there's hints that they are then confined to an institution and confined to an asylum after experiencing this ecstatic. So I guess as Mackin's work sort of shifts and the focus is more on this sense of awe and ecstasy, the dread that comes out of it is just a dread of it, not necessarily that the thing is in and of itself terrifying, but the thingness of it. And I think that's where the noumenal that we've been talking about comes in. It is almost like an encounter with something completely unthinkable that goes beyond phenomenal perception and therefore creates this kind of utter derangement of the soul for these characters. So I think horror isn't really it's not the kind of horror of the insignificance of humankind that you get maybe in a later weird writer like Lovecraft. In actual fact, one of the recurring themes is that at one point in the primeval past, humankind would have been able to manipulate the material substance of the cosmos, that actually the imagination could have shaped and formed the world would have been malleable to the human imagination. So it's not about the insignificance of humankind in the face of a sort of nihilist cosmos, but it is about the inability of modern man to face this transmutation, this ecstatic, originary, creative mass. And, you know, I think that in some ways is where the horror lies. It's also in some ways where Mackin is very philosophical. I mean, I always think of the Chaosmos of Deleuze and Guattari when I read N, and this bit where there's a sort of one of the characters in an inset text is talking about the stuff of the cosmos being malleable to the imagination of early man. So I think it's, I don't know if you agree, James, but I think it's not exactly horror. It's more an inability of our minds to comprehend this, the real stuff of existence.
Yeah, and I'd say that his career as a writer is a success because it has that progress to I love the horror books from the 1890s. I think they're terrific. But yeah, he sort of refines and refines it until he manages to create through real sort of amazing sleight of hand writing like N, which is sort of profoundly disturbing, but very, very difficult to work out, why it's profoundly disturbing. It's like sort of trying to pin, a butterfly, trying to sort of work out, how he does it, basically. Whereas obviously in the earlier work, it's much more straightforward. And in terms of horror, it's much more to do with, visceral disgust and gore. There's plenty of gore in there. Scary monsters, basically. Whereas that sort of drops off as his career progresses. I like scary monsters. I'm not being sort of snobby about that. There is that shift there, and you get over his career, you get a sense of a writer finding a way to express what they always wanted to express, basically, but didn't have the tools to do at the time, I guess. But in terms of horror, Mackin was quite straightforward in saying that he introduced various plot devices like the brain surgery at the beginning of The Great God Pan, because he didn't think he could solve the main story to a modern readership if he didn't have some sort of scientific inciting incident. And he said, 200 years ago, I would have possibly talked about them going to a sort of a witch's Sabbath or something, and that being the trigger. But now he needed something scientific, and again cites Stevenson as saying, Dr. Jekyll orders the chemicals from a pharmacist. He doesn't go and buy them from a witch in a forest. And if you don't do stuff like that, then the modern reader won't buy the story. And he also did read in the genre as well. He was a huge fan of Poe. And also we know he read M.R. James because he recommended M.R. James to his publisher, John Lane, and quite early, before M.R. James. I mean, one of M.R. James's first stories, which I think might have been Canon Albrecht's scrapbook, but I probably got that wrong. As far as his writing about other, his literary criticism, he always cites people like Dickens, those are the sort of what he considered to be serious writers, basically. He absolutely loved Dickens. He was mad about Dickens. And I've got a copy of a book he produced called and edited called A Handy Dickens, where he introduces different excerpts from various novels. But the point I was trying to make there was that he certainly read M.R. James, he certainly read Poe and admired Poe hugely. So he wasn't he didn't accidentally write horror.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, it's worth also saying that he wrote in a whole range of other modes as well. And the journalistic piece is a fantastic read. I mean, part of the thing about Machen is just the prose, the style, the command of sensory experience, the command of language. And, you read him talking about taking a bus to Tottenham, and you read it with, you're compelled, even though there's nothing really of incident. So there's lots of other stuff, and some of it doesn't all work. I mean, even sort of huge Machen enthusiasts, the war writings are very jingoistic, and they're not that successful in lots of ways. And there are
Dr. Stiggins, which everybody jokes about as being completely unreadable.
There's lots of sort of crime journalism as well. So he's interested in, he was reporting on trials. And so there's an interest that he had in writing about sort of what we call true crime now in short pieces. And then there's a book. What's the book? The
Canning Wonder.
His interests do range across, outside of the weird fiction genre, across a whole range of other forms of writing, which is, again, I think part of the appeal of Machen.
Well, one of the things I wanted to bring in, because it's it was often assumed with back to our friend Lovecraft, it was often assumed with Lovecraft that he, you'd read his writing and go, this is a man who was undertaken some occult or spiritual explicit rituals or done something along these lines. And from speaking to some Lovecraft scholars, there's pretty much no evidence that he ever did anything along those lines. Whereas with Machen, if I'm right in thinking, he did spend some time with the Golden Dawn. I mean, is there any other sort of knowledge of him, perhaps, I know, his high Anglican beliefs were very, very important to him, but there is often the joke about high Anglican, really, they'll turn a blind eye to kind of anything as long as you keep going to the church on Sunday. So it's like the church where you can go off and do your own rituals if you kind of want to. So, is there ever any other evidence that he was perhaps, experimenting here or there with other things?
There's definitely...
He was in the Golden Dawn very briefly, and he was devastated after the death of his first wife, and had something like a nervous breakdown. And it was suggested to him that he try Golden Dawn. And he did give it a go and was very disparaging about it. It's quite clear he didn't get anything, helpful out of it. And he's in his memoirs, he's quite straightforwardly scathing about it, and basically says that, this ancient knowledge that was purported to be, they were purported to be holding, he said, was quite clearly a confection, and something that they'd cooked up, basically, which is basically, you know, the Golden Dawn rituals are, you know, were they were claimed to have been received from ancient masters, but they were clearly, you know, scribbled up by MacGregor Mathers, you know, when he was in the British Library reading room, like cobbled together. Sorry, no offense to any Golden Dawn practitioners. I have nothing personal against it. This is Mackin's view.
But Mackin did do his own sort of, he did confect his own sort of, I mean, in the autobiographies, he rejects that, the Golden Dawn, but there is a sense that he'd devised some sort of ritual of his own to deal with his grief, wasn't there? So, which maybe involved self-flagellation.
Which is in the Hill of Dreams, certainly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So it's the same sorts of things that he depicts in fiction in the Hill of Dreams.
It's quite Catholic mortification of the flesh to receive spiritual enlightenment in some way. But another thing he was very disparaging about was also spiritualism, which he sort of rubbished as cheap parlor tricks, basically. So it's another sort of, contradiction there. This person who is intensely religious and mystical, but who also was quite a hard-headed skeptic in lots of ways when it came to modern religious movements. He also spent a year cataloguing an occult catalogue. It's one of his first jobs when he came to London. So his knowledge of the occult and of the Kabbalah and that tradition was, and alchemy, was absolutely staggering. And he certainly used all that in his fiction. And he was also alive. You know, one of his best friends was A.E. Waite, one of his lifelong closest friends, who was obviously, you know, a huge mover and shaker in late Victorian and Edwardian occulture. So he was in that world, but he was quite sort of, he stood apart from it a little as well. But again, was quite happy to use that in his fiction, I think, which is again where you get that conflation of him as an actual, you know, occult a practitioner. I think you could say he dabbled for a few months, and that's about it.
Is there any, that's my sense anyway. Is there any evidence of him? The only reason I ask this is just when I was reading the Green Book section of The White People, it's an uncannily accurate description of occult experience. So, I mean, is there any evidence of him having, you know, perhaps not undertaking it himself, but having an experience, a spiritual experience, mystical experience?
There's an account in Far Off Things around this time when he's experiencing this grief, isn't there, James? Where he talks about the pavements under his feet being springy, and that he experiences this intense joy, which reads almost like a sort of moment of ecstasy. Transmutation. So I think he did have that sense. I mean, he also talks about the an experience in his rooms in his inn at the same time in the late 1890s, where the walls of the room shook as if they were, you know, kind of reeds in a breeze, I think is the image. So there's definitely, on the one hand, because I think the thing about the supernatural, there's I can't remember where it's from, but there's a thing where he talks of it, which is great. A great joke where he talks about if ghosts really were, then Marble Arch, where the site of Tyburn Cross, would be just thronged with aggrieved spectres, and it's not. So therefore, you know, why would you believe in hauntings? But at the same, unlike someone like Algernon Blackwood, who really believed that, you know, went looking for ghosts and believed that they were real, he seems to have not believed in it at all. But there's a difference, isn't there, between believing in ghosts and believing in the mysticism. And there's also a Welsh connection there, I was thinking, because he refers to the works of Thomas Vaughan, who is the brother of the metaphysical Henry Vaughan, who was an alchemist, Welsh alchemist and mystic. And that his name and he's alluded to quite a lot in Mackin's work, isn't he? So I wonder if there's a kind of almost a sense of a Welsh heritage. And the other sort of quasi-mystical thing that Mackin becomes obsessed with through, I think, A.E. Waite introducing him to it or to the idea, is the idea that the Grail is a physical cup, but is a ritual that gets passed to early Welsh Christians, and that is still preserved in some places. And there's a couple of stories. Secret Glory obviously deals in part with that.
To do with sort of spiritual transmutation, isn't it? I think it's a sort of process of spiritual.
Did he have anything to do with Dion?
Transcendence.
Did he have anything to do with Dion Fortune?
I don't think so personally, but James, your previous remark reminded me that, like you, Aleister Crowley thought that Mackin's writing was an absolute sort of repository of occult wisdom and insight and information. And his books are on, I think it's just listed as the works of Arthur Mackin on, Crowley's reading list in Magic and Theory and Practice. For the occult wisdom that's contained therein. Mm. But I think Mackin was probably sort of would be appalled to see him on that list as as an authority on, you know, genuine.
I think in many ways, as I said,
he was an authority.
Most people on that list would probably be appalled to be on that list.
Yeah. Yeah, quite right. Yeah.
So,
but as Tim said, his later interest in Grail lore was deep and very, very genuine, I think. And very distinct. He had a very distinct take on that.
So if we can, because you mentioned earlier, James, that you see a progression in his writing. I mean, I don't want to sort of box him in, but if you feel that progression ended up somewhere, as if he'd, you know, these threads throughout his life to do with the modern world changing, to do with mysticism, perhaps not a conclusion, because everything will always expand onwards, but where do you think he got to as a writer? You know, what was perhaps the final way he saw the world?
That's very tricky. I'd have to think about that. But I guess he reached a point as a writer where his fiction had sort of dovetailed completely with a very, very specific worldview. The thing that's chiseled on his gravestone literally is omnia ex aeunt in mysterium, all ends in mystery. And I think that is his great, was his belief that the whole point of reality and existence is the mystery. It's not trying to sort of penetrate the veil to try and get sort of some sort of insight into the numinous. It was to enjoy the ritual and to celebrate and sort of rejoice in that mystery, and he saw life as a kind of ritual, shadow play basically, somehow reflecting that inner quiddity. He used the term quiddity, which I think is sort of broadly synonymous with what we might call the noumenal, but I think that was his great definitive view of life, is that mystery is all, basically, and that is the whole point of everything. And that's, you know, part and parcel of that is his sort of railing against the modern world, this attempt of science to try and explain and rationalize everything. He saw that as kind of destroying the thing that makes life worth living.
As we're getting up onto an hour here, I'll just ask either of you, because I know there's probably these always with when people are specialists in thinkers, there's always usually this like little area of the thinker that they never get to talk about, but they think is key or they really enjoy. So if there is a key area of Mackin's life or his writing that you feel is overlooked or you think is key to our discussion, I sort of open the floor for you to bring it in if we haven't touched upon it already.
I'll go, Tim, if you don't mind, first, because there is something I feel quite strongly about, which is we have mentioned it briefly. I mentioned his last novel, The Green Round, which traditionally has been dismissed as a kind of very unsatisfactory late work, which isn't really worth bothering with. But I'm very you know, much of the opinion that it's one of the best things he ever wrote, and is a sort of fantastically rewarding novel that should be read a lot more. I don't want to be, there's nothing personal. I don't want to be disparaging against Joshi, but, you know, leading critics of the genre, of Macken as a genre writer, you know, tend to promote this view that Macken's powers waned after about 1900. And, you know, the ensuing decades of his life are really sort of an afterthought to the peaks of his career as a literary artist. Well, I don't subscribe to that view at all. And I think his late work, like The Green Round and N, are absolutely sort of fascinating and deeply rewarding books to read, basically. And, you know, don't ignore them is that's the sort of thing that I'd like to use this opportunity to to argue very strongly.
Yeah, I would absolutely second that. I think there is this sense that because the prose is sort of starker and more journalistic, that people find it less immediately compelling. I think a lot of people will go to The Hill of Dreams as being the work that they'll recommend. But yeah, like James, I think that the there's something really kind of modern and strange, and in I think in some ways that late work is the work that in terms of people, you know, literary people who followed on from him, that's in some ways where the influence has been. So I was talking, my route to Macken was through M. John Harrison, and it is specifically The Green Round, and you've written on this, haven't you, James? That it's specifically The Green Round that he picks up on in his novel, The Course of the Heart. And he takes from The Green Round this figure of a dwarf following around one of the characters. So I think this
and appearing under a street lamp, he lifts that completely.
And there's a like I was saying as well with the sort of Borges, almost sort of Borgesian metatextual quality. Some of the later works have recurring devices or speak to one another, have recurring images. There's in The Green Round and N, there's a book written by a Reverend Hampole in the late 18th century, and I can't remember what it's called, but something about
Meditations on a Walk Through London, I think.
Something like that. And those kind of, you know, like those texts I find way more compelling than the Lovecraft Circle pseudo biblia of all of the sort of like the Necronomicon and all those banned and horrific works of 16th century occultism and alchemy, because it's just, you know, it's obviously a sort of mundane text in which is hidden these weird moments of revelation. I think in N, the Hampole talks to somebody called Glanville, who's replacing the local priest, local vicar, as a locum for a period of time, who has this strange theory of the immutable kind of original stuff of the universe that he tells Hampole. And it's, you know, like the way it's presented is very mundane, and that I think enhances the effect of the metatextual quality of it.
He uses his career as his experience, unhappy largely, he claims it to be his experience as a journalist, really sort of bleeds into his fiction and makes it really potent, because it all does read like reportage in quite a low-key way. It all sort of feels like an overheard conversation, sort of information you're scrapping together, you know, navigating a city. And you get this sense of the events being described, but it's always sort of from some sort of oblique angle, and you can never quite penetrate the actual mystery of what's going on, which of course is the whole point, as Macken would have it. That sort of journalistic verisimilitude really, really makes those later works really, you know, potent, in my opinion.
No, I was only going to just my slight another thing to sort of add is the, so we talked about Mackin's sort of heroes, and he's hieroglyphics, he talks about those texts that achieve the ecstatic. And he always comes back to Rabelais. It's always the Rabelaisian mode that is the quintessence of this kind of ecstatic. And I think you...
And Dickens.
If I remember rightly from hieroglyphics, Mackin talks about how he doesn't quite... I think it's the Pickwick Papers and that sort of almost the quest narrative or the picaresque quality of it that he sees as being the quintessence of where Dickens meets the ecstatic. But yeah, no, I was just going to say that I think the importance of the Dionysian as a mode for Mackin should not be understated. That the drinking is opens up to the ecstatic or certainly for the obscure literary hermit in hieroglyphics, and the idea of drinking and sort of good living is a kind of constant recurring theme. So although he's interested in the ecstatic and the sublime, he's not an ascetic. It's absolutely about, you know, he's a bon viveur and, you know, and a good liver and, you know, pubs and restaurants and eating well and drinking good wine are a huge part of Mackin's outlook. So he said...
Well, that kind of medieval joie de vivre, ecstatic, that medieval ecstatic is another of the, you know, the things that modernity, as far as he can tell, you know, as he sees it, is kind of destroying, basically, which goes back to his, you know, complaints about the Reformation. That kind of that ideal way of mode of existence of the spiritual and the ecstatic intertwined, which is why he also approves of paganism as well, that traditional sort of Roman paganism, for similar reasons, because it was a sort of authentic spiritual. You know, the Carlyle's sort of yes, you know, to life, basically, which he saw the modern world, which he saw being denuded in the modern world, basically.
Well, the first thing he publishes, right, as a schoolboy, is a poem about the rites of Eleusis. So, you know, he's right from the very beginning, he's interested in, yeah, the sort of that tradition of the... the classical world and those kinds of mysterious and ecstatic kind of connections. So I think the Dionysian is an important mood, and I think again can be, we keep coming back to Lovecraft, but it can be opposed to the sort of the Apollonian kind of desire in Lovecraft, this sort of need for order, even when something like in Lovecraft that does spill over into a kind of ecstatic, but almost against Lovecraft's will, whereas Mackin is constantly embracing that mode.
Well, that does tie to the question I was going to ask. I mean, I was simply going to ask how reading so much Mackin and engrossing yourself in his work, how has it personally influenced your life? Has it become more Dionysian, more mysterious?
as I was saying, there's sort of one very sort of specific thing. The Friends of Arthur Mackin AGM weekends do have Dionysian elements, if you call standing around in a pub talking about Mackin Dionysian, which, you know, I guess you could do. That's one very sort of concrete, enrichment I've got from my involvement in Mackin, other society of other Mackin, the company of other Mackin enthusiasts, basically. So that's been terrific over the years, and brought me a great deal of, you know, happiness, basically. Reading Mackin has kind of penetrated lots of other areas of my life, and, you know, my son is named after him, for one. I'm resigned to the fact. Well, I'm happy to be resigned to the fact that he's a big part of my life and will be for the remainder of it, I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, I'd again second that the, you know, conversations and pints with other Macan enthusiasts is always a delight. And also, I think it is about because of that sense of awe and ecstatic, differs from the sort of the weird horror mode. It's even where in his fiction sometimes, you know, there is horror, there is, you know, dread or whatever, there's a real sense of re-enchantment. And I think that that made a big difference to my life reading Macan, is the ability to enjoy or to see things as being kind of, in some way, seeing the ineffable in a, you know, in an ordinary experience, or, you know, walking down an ordinary city street. And, you know, I don't share the Macan's faith, and in some ways, I think as somebody who doesn't believe, I'm often looking for a sense of transcendence that I don't have in my, you know, my personal beliefs. And Macan's fiction is, I think, a way to that, you know, especially, I don't live in London anymore, but I did live in London for a good number of years. And, you know, reading Macan's London work and walking around London, you think, walking, this is where, you know, Cannon's Park in the story end would be. And, you know, there's a sort of sense of real sense of connection. And, you know, there's a really simple thing that Macan did, which was to bring from his childhood on the Welsh borders and his love of the beautiful nature, to bring that into London and enchant the streets of London with the same kind of
all the wonders being within a stone's throw of King's Cross Station is his very
and the other
memorable
thing about,
quote
yeah the other thing about the technique that was just occurred to me is, we've been talking, look, there are these recurrent devices. He's a very clever writer across the whole of his oeuvre. And so one of the things you get in stories right at the beginning of his, or certainly in the 1890s period, and certainly in The Three Impostors, but you also get this image recurring right at the end of his career, is the image of a sunrise or a sunset being like great blasts, doors of a furnace being thrown open in the sky. So he reuses imagery in I think, you know, there's a sense of Macan as a symbolist throughout his, even when the prose gets pared down to that more journalistic, there's a sense of Macan as a symbolist. And I think that sense that there is a kind of a symbolic element to his work which goes through the, you know, across the whole of his corpus, means that you can keep rereading and rereading and trying to puzzle. Yeah. You know, I mean, again, it'll all end in mystery, but it does draw you back into the work again and again.
I'd like to sort of reinforce something you said, Tim, which is that when you read Macan, at least for a little while, he sort of lingers, basically, and you do view the world through a sort of slightly strange prism, which can be a sort of really wonderful one, after reading his. Or every, you know, a story from the earliest works to right up to N, one of his last stories. You read something like N and you just look at things differently for a while afterwards. And that influence lingers. And I think that is the mark of a really, really great writer, that they can actually, you know, have that effect, that you walk away from the book, but it's still with you, and is a sort of, you have this sort of Macan filter. How you see the world for a little while afterwards.
Where would you advise people to begin? Perhaps a way to normally I would just ask that straight up, but perhaps a way to rephrase it, as we've sort of made clear throughout the conversation, that Macan is often a bit constrained to a certain period, maybe the horror period. Maybe one way to phrase this would be, where do you advise people to begin? Perhaps with the classic normal stuff, but then also one other thing, which is, you know, If you weren't into Macan, you'd probably never hear of it. Something outside the normal Macan as well.
I'd say Three Impostors, because you get a lot of bang for your buck, because it's got lots of stories within this sort of framing narrative, which is also great. So Three Impostors from his sort of classic period. And then, you know, as I said, The Green Round, or if you don't want a novel and prefer a short story, then N, I'd say from right at the end of his career. If you read those two things, you'd get a fairly good sense of what he's capable of, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I would probably say that the same, I would probably make the same choices, but I would add a thing that I really like from the 1890s, but not published until the 1920s, are the little stories in that are published in Ornaments and Jade. Just for sort of the technique of them, they're really quite extraordinary. And they're what we'd now call sort of flash fictions. They're many of them just a couple of pages long, you know, couple of thousand words at most, but they do something really extraordinary with mood and tone, and yeah, they're like little ornaments in jade. They're the sort of incredible stories. So I think if reading Mackin, that's the sort of, if you want to read the decadent style, I would say Ornaments in Jade is the sort of, in some ways, the peak of that style. But you know, like an extraordinary collection. But yeah, I'd second N, I think, probably, although it's not really a logical entry point to Mackin's work, if you were only ever going to read one thing by Mackin, I think for me, I would say N should be the one.
All right. Is there anything either of you would like to add about Life of Arthur Mackin or his work that, you know, you feel we need to add?
Just thinking of that question you just asked, it might be worth mentioning that John Betjeman's sort of claimed his life was profoundly altered by reading The Secret Glory when he was a schoolboy. So another one to consider.
I think that's Sam Kunkel's favourite, correct?
Maybe, yeah.
So I think if Sam was here, he would probably recommend The Secret Glory. That's the one he also said to me. He said, if you haven't read that one, you have to read The Secret Glory. So we'll put that one in there. So what is in the pipeline for Faunus and the Society?
We're always very, very keen on receiving submissions from people writing articles, long or short, about Mackin. So we, you know, that's ongoing. There's two editions a year. So we always, you know, welcome newcomers to Mackin to offer their, you know, thoughts and responses to his work. We do have other things in the pipeline. It's a big project, but if you're a member of the Friends of Arthur Mackin, you occasionally get special limited edition publications, normally done through Tartarus Press, so the lovely editions. And we have one in the pipeline that's been in the pipeline for such a long time, I feel slightly sheepish mentioning it because I've got to get on with it, which is a book called Table Talk of Arthur Mackin, which is written by somebody who knew him, and who basically turned his recollections of Mackin's conversation on various subjects, wrote them all down. So it wasn't, you know, it was based on memory. So it's not a sort of authoritative account of Mackin's views on anything. But we're in the process of turning that into a special publication for members of the Friends of Arthur Mackin. And I'd like anybody listening who has any interest in Mackin, do please think about joining the Friends of Arthur Mackin, because it's a really good society to be a part of. And we have these meetings every year, as we've mentioned already, which are an awful lot of fun. And we're always we're a very welcoming bunch, basically.
All right. Well, that seems like a good place to finish up. I'll put the links for the Friends of Arthur Mackin in the links below. And yeah, links for other things, such as your own work, and for Faunus as well. But James Machin and Tim Jarvis, I think it's been a great conversation on Mac. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, cheers. Thank you.